Hello, survivalists. This is the Clark's True Survival Stories. I'm your host, Casey McIntosh. I'm hanging out here with Julie Henningsen. She's sitting in her husband's office that looks like a dorm room for a boy or maybe a frat house. I don't know. How's it going, Julie?
Good. It's going well. Yeah, I'm borrowing some recording space today with some background decor that doesn't necessarily match my personality type.
How is it making you feel? Is it changing your mentality in life in general at all?
Unfortunately, my back's to it, so I'm focused on you.
Good. I was recently reading this book about Dr. Seuss and how he used to put on different hats when he was trying to think up new words. So maybe this is a good change of location.
It's inspiring.
Yeah, exactly. What do you have cooked up for us today?
Well, Casey, today I'm going to tell you the story of four young men who met with tragedy, or I should say near tragedy, on Mount Washington in New Hampshire. Have you ever been to Mount Washington? Do you know anything about it?
Mount Washington, I know, is very windy, right?
Very windy.
Very windy.
Yes.
I've driven past. I've heard that it is extremely challenging to hike and whatnot just because of the wind. And there is a little video that we should link in the show notes of a person at the top of Mount Washington having a picnic lunch. Have you ever seen that?
I don't think so. In the wind?
Yeah. It's a total spoof on Mount Washington. You know, they're pouring the coffee and it's going blowing away. So it's just a good way of envisioning the mountain.
That is one of the things that Mount Washington is most known for. For a long time, nearly 62 years, Mount Washington, as I mentioned, is in New Hampshire, and it held the record for the fastest wind gust ever recorded on the surface of the earth at 231 miles per hour.
What?
That was recorded in 1934 by the Mount Washington Observatory staff near the peak of the mountain.
Crazy. Are they still monitoring wind speeds up there?
Yeah.
I'm sure they are.
Yeah. Yeah, it still gets very windy. That record actually was broken, though, in 1996 when wind speeds of 253 miles per hour were recorded in Australia. So Mount Washington still holds the record for the fastest wind gust in North America, maybe in the Northern Hemisphere, actually, but not in the world. So needless to say, with weather conditions like that, and it's a very popular place. There's a lot, hundreds of thousands of people that visit this area yearly. So there's a lot of opportunity for people to get caught in bad weather, environmental situations.
What do you think is the drive for people to visit Mount Washington? Is it all of the hype and attention that it's had for having a little bit of wild weather and people are really curious about it? They have to go check it out, or is there something else in the area?
Well, so I've been there myself, and I'll just tell you a quick, what I think is kind of a funny story about my Mount Washington experience. This was like over 20 years ago. I was working in a university outdoor recreation program, and I decided to plan a trip to the White Mountains. So I got out all my 7.5 minute USGS maps and just got into this kind of backcountry trip planning mode. And I'm looking at all this, you know, wildland trail system and planning this backpacking trip. I'd never been there before. I'd never heard of the White Mountains. I'd never heard of the Presidential Range, never heard of Mount Washington or Tuckerman's Ravine, which if you're familiar with the area, you've certainly heard of that, but I hadn't. So I planned what I thought was going to be this just really remote multi-day backcountry backpacking trip for this group of students I was working with. We drove all the way out there from the Midwest and had our heavy packs, all our food, all our resources, and we headed out on the same trail that I'm going to tell this story that occurred years later on the Hermit Lake Trail. And so we were just prepared for this, you know, just kind of isolated, quiet, peaceful backcountry experience. And we get 5 or 6 miles down this trail towards the Tuckerman Ravine, which is on the map. And I'm just picturing this, you know, beautiful wild ravine. We kind of come around a corner, and I'm not kidding. There were thousands of people.
What? And
apparently, this is a really super popular spring skiing and tubing and hiking place that just tons and tons of people go to. So it was just like being on this giant mountainside party where people were hiking and skiing and
drinking keg stands.
Doing all kinds of things. And here I am with these students that I brought for this remote backcountry experience. And our minds were blown a little bit. It was not what I pictured, but really cool. And really,
did you join the party?
Well, we were just passing through, but we did join the party for a little bit and kind of got the lay of the land and really learned what the area is all about, which is not what I was thinking. But we were headed up Mount Washington, up the Tefferman Ravine Trail, and we made that climb. And it's, you know, not that big of a mountain compared to our Western standards here. It's only 6,288 feet tall, which sounds small. But with the weather and kind of the environment, the lower tree line, the scree, the steepness of the terrain, it can be a challenging climb. But to answer your question, I think one of the reasons that it's popular is there's a road that you can take, a pretty easy paved road that drives you right up to the summit, 7 miles up. And you can buy your bumper sticker that says, I drove up Mount Washington or something like that. So a lot of people like to do that too. Another way of getting to the windy top. In fact, 45,000 cars drive up that road every year, which
wow.
just gives you a idea of, you know, it's kind of in a middle of a sort of densely populated area, again, compared to where we are. So,
yeah. Is there anything on the top or just?
Yeah, there's a little observatory and there's a little plaque that talks about the wind speed. Anyway, it's a pretty neat place. The Presidential Range, 19-mile range of mountains, 13 different mountains named mostly after U.S. presidents, not completely. So the tallest mountain in this 19-mile range is Mount Washington. And when these peaks were named, probably over 100 years ago, it was a pretty simple process. There was a group of locals that had hiked up to a vista and could kind of see the range clearly in front of them. And in fact, interestingly, from the top of Mount Washington, you can see 5 different states, Maine, Vermont, New York, Massachusetts, New Hampshire, and Canada. So pretty incredible in all directions. But they simply just started with the tallest mountain, named it Mount Washington. And then the next tallest peak was named for the second president, John Adams, and so on. Third peak was, you know, third president. Mount Adams, Jefferson, Madison, Monroe. And then they eventually ran out of presidents and named one after Ben Franklin. And later a mountain was named Mount Eisenhower. So came to be the Presidential Range. And there's a nice, challenging, long, fun backpack you can do through there, which I did do years later after my first venture. I think it's called the Presidential Traverse, which just gives you a full flavor of that chunk of the country, which is really remarkable. So despite the crazy potential weather conditions, people like to hike this mountain year round. And our story takes place on December 28th, 2013. 4 young men, Adam Herman, Connor Lodge, and his brother Tristan Lodge, and a 4th friend, Richard Quebec, who went by the name of RK, all decided to try and climb Mount Washington. They were friends from growing up together on Martha's Vineyard. They were in their early 20s by this point and had kind of gone off to different colleges and were back together over the winter break. And Connor and Tristan were brothers, and they had decided to climb Mount Washington. So 2 of their party, Adam and Connor, had the intentions of just climbing the peak, leaving that morning, making it to the top, and coming back down by the end of the day. And then the other 2, Tristan and RK, had packed big, heavy packs. They had a little bit more time, and they were going to move a little bit more slowly and spend the night overnight and do a little backpacking.
So
they had
bags
and layers and food and their, you know, sleeping pads. So they were kind of moving at different paces to begin with, which in retrospect, the young men kind of blamed their story on that, thinking that if they had all been sticking together, what happened might not have happened. They set out on this Hermit Lake Trail early that Saturday morning, and they're making their way up. They had ice axes. I don't know if they had crampons or micro spikes on their shoes, but they're pretty well prepared for cold, windy, snowy, icy conditions. And as they're making their way up, the 2 that were just out for the day had lighter packs and were just moving generally faster. RK, who was carrying a heavy pack, had a knee injury, and that was slowing him down a bit. So they got to a point where they realized if the two faster moving hikers were going to make it to the summit, they needed to sort of split away and go their own pace, which was a little bit faster. So the group of four decided that the two faster moving climbers would forge ahead, get to the summit, turn back. They would meet up with the other two on the way down, and then they would reunite at that point, which is exactly what happened. They made it to the summit around 2:30 that afternoon. And shortly thereafter, the weather started to change. It started to get cold. It was windy, 70 miles an hour gusts. And they realized that the idea of kind of hanging out and waiting for their partners probably wasn't going to be a good one. They were thinking about the potential for frostbite, for hypothermia, just sort of standing there and waiting. So as the slower climbers ascended, still trying to go for the summit of the mountain, they did wait for maybe 15 minutes before they just decided this is not a good idea. We'll just start moving at a slower pace and we'll go slow enough that they can eventually catch up with us. We'll reunite further down on the trail and come back together. Yeah. So they had gone from this Hermit Lake Trail to the Lion Head Trail, which is the way to get up to the summit of Mount Washington. And they had planned to sort of stick to that route on the way back down. So as the two faster climbers, Adam and Connor, were kind of moving slowly, trying to bide their time and allow their buddies to catch up with them, the weather moved in and it became pretty low visibility. They had some whiteout conditions. And they came to a split in the trail where the Lionhead Trail meets the Tuckerman Trail, which is not the trail that they had come up. They got a little disoriented and unknowingly they veered to the right when they should have gone left and ended up on this Tuckerman Trail. They had decided to follow a set of prints, footprints that they'd seen in the snow, thinking that this was the right way to go. So they're making their way just shortly after this Y in the trail when suddenly they felt a little shift beneath them. And Adam was quoted as saying, "I didn't know we were walking on a shelf of snow until mid-conversation, the shelf started to give out under my feet." They immediately recognized that they were in an avalanche. Yeah. So Adam said about this shelf shifting underneath him at that moment, it was one of those seismic shifts that drives your stomach into your throat and triggers something primal in your brain. And I knew very suddenly and very clearly that I had walked onto the lip of a dangerously loaded snowfield and we were now in an avalanche. He said, "I tried to spike my ice pick into the ravine to anchor myself, but found no purchase. It was much too late for that. Then I was in the air."
Hey.
So at that moment, Connor and Adam are swept up in this avalanche and they're being thrown and tossed and getting glimpses of white and glimpses of black and running into things. Connor was able to kind of try and stick his leg out to try and slow his fall, break his fall a little bit. They're both trying to swim as you're supposed to do if you're caught in an avalanche, kind of swim yourself up to the surface a bit. But ultimately, they fell estimated about 800 feet down the Tuckerman Ravine from the top before they came to a stop. Connor stopped a little bit further uphill from Adam, and the avalanche came to a stop, and the boys just laid there for a moment and assessed, you know, their state.
That is a long way to travel, 800 feet. That would be a horrifying ride.
Exactly. Unfortunately, neither of them were buried in the avalanche. When Adam sort of came to and was at a stop, he looked around. His head was above snow. He could immediately tell that he had broken his arm. He had an angulated arm fracture. He had some pain in his back. He could see his boot off to the side. It had been sort of just blown off of his foot. And he tried to sit up and move, but quickly realized, okay, that might not be a good idea. So he just sort of laid back in the snow for estimated about 15 minutes, kind of trying to gather his thoughts and figure out what his next move would be. So as he's laying there, kind of taking inventory of his injuries, he hears boots coming up behind him on the snow and looks up and sees Connor. And there's Connor standing above him, able to walk, able to move. but lots of bruises and scratches and blood on his face. And Connor's looking at him and just says, "Who are you? Who are you?" And starts to ask him who he is, doesn't recognize him, which Adam immediately recognized, indicated he has a head injury, a closed head injury, and is having some amnesia and altered mental status at this point.
Wow. So if you had to pick between altered mental status and angulated broken arm and potentially a lumbar fracture, what would you choose?
Well, I don't know if it was lumbar, but yeah.
I'm just thinking, anywhere in your back, it might be broken. Your back might be broken. Yeah, your arm is for sure broken, but your brain is functioning normally. I don't know. I think you have to go with the broken body.
Yeah, I'd pick the broken body over the broken brain.
Yeah. What time of day was this at this
point? So it was like late afternoon. Yeah. They had summited at 2:30 and were kind of hoping to get down before sunset. So this was before sunset.
And with 70 plus mile an hour winds, you can imagine that it would be a total whiteout.
So the two boys are there, not really sure what they're going to do next. Connor is out of it and he's taking a more pessimistic approach to their situation. Adam is with it cognitively and taking a more optimistic approach, kind of thinking about, okay, here's how we're going to survive. Here are the things we're going to do to keep us going. Whereas Connor apparently was kind of like taking inventory of his life and thinking about what is the afterlife going to be like? And this is it. And am I comfortable with facing my own death? And these types of thoughts that Adam did not find to be very helpful. And he commented that, you know, I don't know if it was his head injury or just his general disposition, but they sort of went two different directions mentally with the situation that they found themselves in.
You always just need one positive thinker, though, because if they were both in that negative mindset, then they would both be screwed. So did these boys have cell phones or cell phone service up there? I didn't ask you about that on Mount Washington.
Yeah, I don't think so. Okay. I don't think so. Yeah, I think not. They may have had phones, but they did not have any communication, reliable communication devices that were working in the environment they're in. But here's where our story turns. Just when they think it can't get any worse, well, no, let's take that out. It doesn't get worse. Here's where our story turns. As you recall, Tristan and RK were behind them on the trail and they were coming down. And remember, Tristan is Connor's brother.
Right.
And they get to this Y in the road where you can go right down the Tuckerman Trail or left down the trail that they came up on. And they go a short distance in the correct direction. They were not kind of disoriented. So they're headed down the right trail, but they're not seeing their buddies when they thought they should have seen them already. So Connor's brother, Tristan, just gets this feeling like, I don't think this is right. We need to head back. We need to kind of be a little bit more methodical about our approach here. So they head back to the junction and Tristan sees footprints headed off down the Tuckerman Trail in the wrong direction. And they follow those footprints out a little bit and they see the footprints just end abruptly at what was clearly the head of a fresh avalanche. So wow. He had this kind of gut feeling, this intuition that led him to realize that Connor and Adam were in a lot of trouble.
Can you imagine experiencing that, walking to that trail and seeing the remnants of an avalanche or just like seeing that fresh avalanche and just knowing that your brother is, you know, your friends are potentially gone, you know, that had to be really heavy.
Heavy. And that's one thing Tristan said is when he realized that, he's like, we are not stopping until we get these guys out of here. He was just focused on rescuing them, going for help. And he was able to yell down. It was like a 60 degree slope. So he couldn't go to them, but was able to yell down to them. We're going for help. We know that you're there. We'll be back as soon as we can, which Connor and Adam both later just said was like the most glorious moment ever, hearing that voice, hearing a familiar voice and knowing help was on the way.
So it was too steep of a slope and they were probably a little bit concerned about triggering more avalanches I could imagine that it potentially could be dangerous to be walking on that slope. So,
well, it was safer above them, but they didn't want to go down any further, like you said, for fear of triggering more avalanche. And they weren't able, due to their injuries, to go up.
Right.
And I think Kristen was like, well, I'm not going to go down any further because time is of the essence. I got to get out of here and go for help, which is exactly what they did.
What's unfortunate is that the boys above had all of the supplies that the boys below needed, like the sleeping bags, all of the food, probably anything to keep them safe and warm while they were waiting for rescue.
Yeah. Yeah. The train might have been impassable for them to get them those supplies.
Yeah. What a bummer.
Tristan and RK head as fast as they can for help. It's getting late in the day now, sunset-ish time. And Adam and Connor are left for about 5 hours just laying in the snow. They're spooning, trying to stay warm. Adam's trying to cheer Connor up. Connor's speculating about his impending death. And Adam's, you know, again, thinking really positively and how he's going to retell this story and how long does it take a broken arm to heal and what's coming next. He did have his moments of thinking he might lose some digits or even limbs to frostbite, but really never gave up hope.
You know, Julia, remember when we were talking about hurricanes and I was saying that I really don't want to be stuck in a gymnasium waiting out a natural disaster? I think that this sounds like a harder time to have patience, especially if you're the one with a positive mindset and you're spooning with someone who only has negative things to say. That would be so hard.
Yeah. And I think what helped Adam, he wrote an article about this that I read, and he commented that he had worked as a lifeguard for years. He'd seen head injuries before, so he kind of knew that it was probably the head injury talking and that, you know, that's just part of managing an injury like that.
Right. He had the insight to know that it wasn't just his friend's piss poor attitude.
So finally, around 9 p.m., lights appeared below them, and a couple of rangers, Beth and Sam, reached them, carrying food and extra layers of clothes and resources, and stayed with them while several more hours passed before a snowcat appeared and could bring them down. They did put Adam on a backboard. They transported him with spinal protection, got the boys to the Memorial Hospital in North Conway, New Hampshire. And they did find that not only did he have a broken arm, but he did have a fracture in his spine as well.
Where was it?
I don't know. I did not see that in my research. But I did get the impression that he did not have a spinal cord injury, just a bone injury. And that Connor was diagnosed with a pretty massive head injury, concussion, traumatic brain injury. So Adam went into surgery, had some pins and rods put in his arm, and they both made a recovery and kind of lived to recount the events to the media and even write articles about it. Let me just see if I have any more.
I don't know that Mount Washington is really calling to me, Julie. I think I can just pass. I mean, it's not that I have some adventure.
Take your time. Yeah, just go on a sunny day. Have a low threshold for turning around. I think a lot of these stories are folks that kind of push the limits of, I'm not saying this one is because it was more of a wrong turn in the trail, but not Washington in general, a lot of the stories that you hear are maybe folks that are pushing the limits of what's reasonable for conditions to be doing what they're doing.
Well, I mean, I've been in Glacier Park in some areas where the wind is just unbelievable. You almost have to crawl in areas where there's no wind protection. And that part of it just doesn't sound very pleasant to me. There's a lot of mountains to climb in the world.
Right. Yeah, I'm kind of a fair weather outdoors person. I'm quick to shelter on a cold, windy day or pull out my electric mittens.
Oh, fancy.
That I got for Christmas. Yeah.
You need a way of charging them. You need like one of those panels, panels.
Yeah, portable solar charger panel. Right. Yeah, that's true. So, Casey, just a few tips, pieces of advice for surviving an avalanche if you ever find yourself in that situation. The first is prevention. Avoid terrain sloped between 30 and 45 degrees, which is where avalanches tend to occur. Consider taking an avalanche training class if you recreate in snowy, steep places. And if you do get caught in a slide, there's things you can do to minimize the danger of being buried. And one of them I already mentioned is this concept of swimming, swim to safety. With your feet downhill and kind of in a sitting position, using your hands and arms in a swinging, swimming motion to try and keep your body moving towards the surface of the snow to stay there. Our bodies are 3 times more dense than the surrounding snow, so it's really easy to get pulled deep in this flurry quickly and get buried. And the other thing you can do is try and prepare a little air pocket right in front of your face by putting your palms up by your forehead and your elbows out and creating a cocoon, a little gap in front of your face. Take a deep breath and hold it. The more your lungs can expand before you're like locked in a jail of ice, the better, the more ability you'd have to breathe and take deeper breaths if you do get kind of compacted under the snow. And yeah, and if you have the wherewithal to think about it, when the slide is slowing, the idea of punching your hand up towards the sky to kind of create a little passage or a little pocket in the snow for you to be able to breathe through. Asphyxia is the main cause of death in most avalanche accidents. Some people succumb to blunt trauma from being tossed down a mountain with trees and rocks and all of the debris that you're being thrown around with. But for most folks, it's the asphyxiation that occurs when their airways, sometimes full of snow and ice, and they can't move and aren't found quickly enough. Of course, where we live and play and work, we are used to carrying beacons and snow or probes and hopefully traveling with folks who would know what to do to find us quickly if we're in that situation, the kind of thing you might learn in an avalanche training.
Right. I think one of the most important things is know who you're traveling with and make sure that they have the experience to be out there as well, because all it takes is one weak link and things can take a disastrous turn. You know, someone says, hey, we should go this way. Well, maybe that's not the right move. You know what I mean? Like right. Thinking about those things in advance, because I've definitely in my younger days made decisions where I thought after the fact that was not very bright. I shouldn't have been out with those people. But, you know, live and learn, I guess.
Yeah, and also just listening to your gut and to your intuition and to your like inner knowing, which I think is something that it gets easier the older, at least for me, the older I get. It's hard when you're young. I mean, you don't have that life experience. You know, experience comes from, or what do they say? Good judgment comes from experience, and experience comes from bad judgment.
Oh, I like that. I like it.
Yeah. If an avalanche victim can be rescued within 18 minutes, the survival rate is greater than 91%. That's pretty good.
Wow.
So time is of the essence. The survival rate drops to 34% in burials that last between 19 and 35 minutes. And after 1 hour, only 1 in 3 victims buried in an avalanche is found alive.
There's a story that happened locally here. I'll have to find about an avalanche that kept someone buried. He would have been the 1 in 3.
Oh, good.
So one of these days, I'll pull that out of my pocket.
I'm glad he was the 1 in 3.
Right.
So there you have it, Casey. That is the story of Adam, Connor, Tristan, and RK on the slopes of Mount Washington, Tuckerman Ravine. And through the course of researching this story, there's just so many others on Mount Washington. So we'll come back to this place in future episodes. There's a lot of survival stories to tell here.
To sum it all up, I have to say, my mother-in-law has this poster in her house, and it's a commercial for like Marlboro cigarettes or something like that. She's not a smoker, but that's beside the point. It says, doing anything with anyone at any time could be potentially hazardous to your health.
That is funny.
I know.
True. Hey, well, life's all about taking risks.
I guess so. Even when you don't realize, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's a good story.
Thanks for listening today. Before we wrap up, we'd like to again ask for your support in spreading the word about the Crux True Survival Stories. If you enjoyed the episode, take a moment to visit our Instagram page at the Crux Podcast. We encourage you to share our latest posts on your stories and help us reach more fellow survival enthusiasts and storytellers. We would love to hear from you. If you have survival stories you'd like to share or topics you'd like us to explore, reach out at thecruxsurvival@gmail.com. Thanks for your support.
Yes, thank you for your support. And if you have a moment and you enjoy listening, please leave a rating and review. We could definitely use some to help us get out there. So thank you. Have a great week.
Have a great week. Thanks,
Casey. Enjoy the spring weather. Yes, we'll talk soon.